Good morning and welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Al Morales, your host and managing partner of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. We created the center in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. The Business of Government Radio Hour features a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. Our special guest this morning is Ellen Embry, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Force Health Protection and Readiness and Director of Deployment Health Support at the U.S. Department of Defense. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning.
And joining us in our conversation, also from IBM, is Russ Sanford, Director in IBM's DoD practice. Good morning, Russ.
Good morning.
Ellen, to provide a proper context around this subject of military medicine, could you give us a general sense of the history and mission of the Department of Defense's health affairs?
Yes, I'll try. The Department of Defense's health affairs programs evolved primarily since 1949 when the Office of the Department of Defense was established. Health affairs has enjoyed having a specific assistant secretary advocate for the health programs within the department to establish not only the programs for protecting the force, but also to advise the Secretary of Defense as they move forward. Primarily, the office provides policy program guidance and sets standards for the execution of health and the delivery of health by the services. And that has continued to evolve and become more effective and efficient through time.
Can you give us some specifics around the mission and the scope of the Office of Force Protection and Readiness of which you lead?
It might be easier to talk about what I don't do because
okay.
The Assistant Secretary's office deals with the delivery of health care to the entire Department of Defense service members and their beneficiaries, including retirees. I don't do that. We also establish clinical policies and how the health providers in the system, what standards they have to clinically adhere to and the standards of pharmaceuticals and things like that that are used in the system. I don't do that either.
Okay.
But what I do is about everything else. I engage in trying to understand how we maintain a healthy fighting force, and we look at it from a prevention point of view, from a protection point of view, and from a point of care on a battle space and making sure that we have the medical assets available in that battle space to deliver the care to help them survive and to get back to definitive care in the state. So it's everything that isn't the day-to-day peacetime health care delivery. It covers longitudinally what we do in peacetime and wartime, but it's specifically focused on the deploying force.
Ellen, you've given us a good idea of this mission and the scope of your directorate. Can you talk to us a little bit and give us an idea of how your directorate is organized, the size of the budget, how many employees you have working for you to support the program?
I'm double-hatted, as you mentioned at the beginning. I have a very small staff, eight, in fact, including myself and my secretary, who advises the assistant secretary on policy matters. And we exercise oversight of the execution of those policies with that staff. And my other hat is the Director of Deployment Health Support. I manage about 12 individuals, government employees, and then the rest of the staff that I work with is contracted support. And that's about 70 to 80, sometimes more depending upon surge requirements. The budget is about $20 million. And it also increases with Global War on Terrorism supplemental. Our work, because we focus on deployment health and the programs and policies in place to execute that during time of war, we are significantly expanded right now because we are engaging in deployment health issues with the ongoing war on terrorism. So we do get a fair amount of additional funding to deal with the ongoing deployment of our forces.
It's a very high contractor to government employee ratio.
Yes, it is. It's quite challenging. In fact, I've been in the process of trying to justify, and in fact, I think I'm going to be successful into converting some of our contractor resources to full-time equivalents in the force. Again, because we managed deployment health issues and we weren't deploying for a period of time, you didn't need a large staff to evaluate what you might do. Well, now for several years we are doing, and the work requires a significant amount of workload, and we are going to try to make accommodations. We believe the global war on terrorism is not going away, and so we have to organize for success in that arena.
Can you talk to us a little bit now about some of the specific responsibilities that you have as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Office of Force Protection and Readiness and the Deployment Health Support Directorate?
I think the most important thing that I have is to make sure that I understand the operating reality out there. I have to work very closely with the Surgeons General in each of the services, with the combatant commanders who are our primary customers. They are the ones that look to the services and the department for making sure we deliver them the capability they need to execute their jobs. Understanding what that is, keeping current with the changing requirements, and then assuring that we're a step ahead of the program guidance to ensure effective, joint, seamless operations with a medical force that's also delivering peacetime care is a challenge. I spend most of my time understanding what the challenges are and challenging my staff to work with the proper customer base to make sure that we are posturing ourselves for success. I think the major focus that I've been looking at here recently is to try to understand more effective ways to do business, to streamline, to leverage other activities, and to bring together the three services into a more coherent end-to-end process. And so that's really what I do. My staff really does all the hard work.
They'll be glad to hear that. Ellen, you started your career in public service back in the mid-70s. Can you describe your career path progressing through the ranks and to your current role, please?
I don't have a traditional career path. I mean, actually, I started as a GS-2 clerk typist. I was a summer hire for the Civil Service Commission. I was in college at the time, and I was a psychology major, and I thought a government job typing would just get me good money. To make a long story short, I learned about an opportunity to compete for an intern program in the government, and I applied for it and was accepted. And I worked in the Civil Service Commission and supported the task force, which led to the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978. That gave me some interesting opportunities with the establishment of OPM and the Merit Systems Protection Board. I learned quite a bit about things. And as part of my follow-on assignments in that organization, I did audits of different headquarters agencies in the Washington, D.C. area to find out how personnel policies actually supported the agencies in doing their primary missions. I learned a lot about what not to do, and that informed me for my future. When President Reagan was elected, he sought to reduce the size of the federal government, and the then head of OPM determined that OPM would set the example. And I was a very, very young GS-13 at the time, and in the RIF process, I landed in the Department of Defense. I was hired by the Defense Contract Audit Agency to be a program analyst, even though I was a personnelist. What I did there was do basically efficiency reviews that followed on those types of audits that I did in OPM, and worked there for a period of time, and then was called up to work for the Assistant Secretary in Reserve Affairs to help them handle some legislative initiatives that were imposed on that office involving computer systems. That was back in the early 80s when everybody was on mainframe remote computers and the audit agency was trying to move to LANs and WANs. And I knew about that because my college days I had to take a foreign language and I took computers instead. And so I had a knowledge of computers that they wanted to leverage. So it was kind of interesting there. And so they leveraged that and moved me to OSD to provide assistance. I was a non-techno-speak person that could explain computer issues in English to the assistant secretary. And so that's why I was hired. I didn't have much background in that either. So I'm an atypical career person. I think the lesson here is, and it is repeated over and over again throughout my career, is if you're open-minded, you're analytical, you're able to solve complex problems, You can do just about anything if you're given enough time to learn what the problem is and work with the experts who can assist you. And I think that has been demonstrated in all of my career path, and you know, from personnel to contract auditing to information systems to legislative and budget affairs. And I've done all those things. I stayed in the reserve affairs community for a long time, trying to understand how we could better leverage the reserve community in the department, and went through a lot of different other issues. But before I left reserve affairs, I was engaged in trying to understand, as a matter of policy, how the department's reserve components might assist in attacks in the government. And when that issue became quite important during the, I guess, the Clinton administration, with the Secretary Cohen, you know, pulled out the bag of sugar and said, if this was anthrax, what would you do? You know, that kind of thing. I worked issues from the reserve component's perspective, again, not with a background in biochemical warfare or anything like that, but just to evaluate how we might better prepare the nation to respond to that. In the context of working those issues, I spent a great deal of time working with the Justice Department and with other parts of the U.S. government on how we organize in this country to respond to weapons of mass destruction threats and to mitigate them when they do occur and to recover from them. I learned as part of that process that there's always a health response required in small, medium, and large events of those types. And I spent a lot of time with HHS and the department's medical resources to try to understand how we should prepare ourselves for that. And I started to engage with the medical community that way. I ended up being asked to act as the Assistant Secretary for Reserve Affairs in the transition time between the Clinton administration and the most recent Bush administration. I was asked to help them define how this would happen. When the new political appointee team came in, they asked me if I would be willing to go over and fill a slot over in health affairs that focused on health issues. So I said, okay. So, you know, what does that tell you? I don't know. It tells you be flexible, have some core competencies, be willing to listen to experts, and play well with others. And, you know, you can go and do just about anything and be successful at it.
Well, Ellen, it certainly tells me that you have a wide range of skills and an incredible style and management approach, which has made you successful over the years. How critical is force health protection to military operations? We will ask Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Force Health Protection and Readiness and Director of Deployment Health Support, Ellen Embry, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.